Good morning, folks. We've got a great lineup for you today. At 12:30, we're going to visit with Samuel Palumbo, the 8th District Captain of the NOPD, as well as Taylor Dials, the OHSS Deputy Director. That's the folks that deal with the homeless services and strategy, about this operation that was spearheaded in the French Quarter. And we'll get a follow-up as to what is actually happening there. A lot of the residents, a lot of the business owners were very happy about the fact of that announcement. We'll find out what the outcomes have been. Liz Murrell, the Attorney General for the state of Louisiana, joins us, and she'll talk about NOLA ID. And I'll talk a little bit about that in my opening remarks as well. Really kind of strange, you know, how this fits into the overall scheme of things. We'll also talk about Judge Derbigny and his courtroom mess, collecting a check, doing nothing for quite a lengthy period of time. Where's the oversight? Who's responsible for this? Has our public offices become the conduit to just have mailbox money? Go to the mailbox, pick up a check? No accountability? It's really a mess. And this is not the only district court that's got into these types of examples. There are others. The question is, what are we going to do about it? We'll also talk about Medicaid fraud arrest. At 11:30, Kelly Schultz joined you, Senior VP Communications and PR with New Orleans & Company. Summer in the City, culinary restaurant deals, and other August happenings that are going on in the city. If you've not been to culinary and taking advantage of these restaurant deals, and they're also going to have cocktail deals this year, you are truly missing out. We'll talk about why. The NOLA Coalition segment will visit with Kai Werder, the Deputy Director of the Center for Restorative Approaches. We'll talk about the things that they do within this organization. What is the restorative approach? How does it end up happening? Young adults, young leaders in our city. Mark Earhart joins us at 10:30, the president of the Earhart Group. He wrote an opinion piece about whether or not Louisiana is going to side with Trump's energy agenda or trial lawyers. And he'll talk about what a lot of folks were all excited about, tort reform, in the past session, but doesn't seem to address these coastal lawsuits, and we'll find out more then. So you've heard me say over and over again, listen really closely to the candidates, and you're going to get a better understanding of who they are, why they are, and where they're going to stand on some very, very important issues that are impacting this city and the greater New Orleans area. And it revealed itself in the sheriff's race, because we had a candidate that really believes that New Orleans is a sanctuary city. Michelle Woodfork, who worked for the NOPD, seems to believe that we are. So the question really is, why is that? Why is it that one who's running for an independent elected office believes that we're a sanctuary city and believes that they are bound by that designation, whether or not it's true or not? Well, it doesn't take much research to figure this all out as to whether or not you are bound by any of this. And the reality is you're not. And then to add insult to injury, they passed a state law here recently that said you can't be. But this is the real irony. As an independent elected sheriff, you choose what you want to involve yourself in. To give you an example, you could be a 287G program sheriff's office. And you can operate under three different models that are offered by the Department of Homeland Security, or U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, And these models are the jail enforcement model, the warrant service officer model, and the task force model. The one that makes the most sense for the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office is the jail enforcement model. And that simply is that you can you go through the training and your officers can interrogate individuals about their, go figure, immigration status. If they've been arrested, and you can facilitate in placing immigration detainers. It doesn't mean that you actually have to detain them, but you can cooperate with immigration by letting them know that you have an individual who's been arrested, and they can then account for that individual. That individual will be fingerprinted. They can collect those fingerprints so that they know who this individual is in the future, because they may or may not have even known this individual was in the country, right? Is there anything wrong with that? Why would we not want to do that? Some of these same candidates went on to say that, you know, their obligation was only if they had committed a violent crime. Well, what obligation? They don't really define that. Now, there are some restrictions placed upon this office because of the federal consent decree. Makes sense. You're in jail, overcrowded conditions. You don't want to be holding individuals that have not a lot of serious crime in their history. But you do want to let immigration know who they are, why they are, and maybe they have an interest in holding them. Considering the following. A violent crime does not include DWI. What if you are struck by an individual who, illegal, has no insurance, you suffer severe bodily injuries, right? You can't even figure out who this individual is or otherwise. We have our hands around them. If you're not able to recover and you're going to bear the complete and total cost of this, I don't know about you, but I would at least like the individual to get deported, right? But during the course of this presentation, it's interesting what candidates are saying, that we should be treating these individuals with dignity and respect. So I always like to go to Webster to start this conversation off. What is dignity? It's the state of the quality of being worthy of honor and respect. So when they cross the border illegally, were they exercising dignity for the United States? Respect is a due regard for the feelings, the wishes, the rights, or traditions of others. Do they respect us? They know they're violating the law. They know they're coming across illegally. They may be coming across for good reason, but still, they don't respect our traditions, our norms, our customs, and more importantly, our laws. So how do we treat them in an undignified or non-dignified way by simply cooperating with federal law enforcement? I've not been able to find anyone who's willing to address that. Where's the lack of dignity? If you violated the law to begin this process, you've now entered a jail, you've been arrested for something else, another violation against the customs, the norms of our society that make up the very basis for our laws, how is it that we're treating you in an undignified way by cooperating with ICE? The same holds true with respect. How are we treating you or disrespectful to you by simply doing what we take an oath of office to do? To enforce the Constitution and laws of the United States, to enforce the Constitution and laws of this state, and to adhere to the ordinances of this municipal jurisdiction. That's an oath that we take. So how did we get to this part of this imbalance where we elect you to do a job, but yet we will allow you to impose your ideology on the masses. It's why it's important to pay close attention to what they are saying. They're misleading you because they can participate in all kinds of different ways to cooperate with the federal government. They choose not to. They try to confuse you about what they are bound to or what they are not bound to. I don't know about you. Whatever ICE ends up doing with the individual, I really want law enforcement to gain their identity, get their fingerprints, and forward the information over to ICE and let the chips fall where they may. Because we don't really know what this individual may or may not have done in other areas of the country. They're very transient. We've seen that over and over again. We've seen Democrats put up poster child immigrants, illegal immigrants, up there only days later to find out the individual has a rap sheet about 3 miles long, has been deported 3 times, has come back, which is now a felony. And we're still talking about the dignity and respect that we owe to this individual, but this individual owes you, me, the masses in this country, the citizens of this country, no dignity and no respect. It's interesting. What's also interesting, as you've heard me say this before, is that we do not stand up the same way for other arrested individuals who are in fact citizens of this country. I mean, it's absolutely disingenuous and mind-numbing to me that we continue to go down this path. It's all right if we arrest every citizen in the country, and it's okay if we separate their families, but illegals, not so much. Can't do that. Disrespectful. Lacks dignity. This is nuts. Pay close attention to what they're saying. Now, it may be understandable to understand, you know, about this confusion about whether or not, you know, we are bound by some kind of, you know, sanctuary city mandate or otherwise. I don't know. Because we're always trying really hard to do things to work around the traditions and the norms and the laws of the city, the state, and this country. So, you know, top priority item for the city of New Orleans, I brought this up the other day, was a municipal ID. Where did this notion come from? What in the hell is this about? Why would we create another ID that doesn't require the highest level of verification in supporting documentation to create more confusion? We have a jail right now that can't seem to identify much of anybody in the jail and can't figure out who's in, who's out, and who they are. So we will create another level of an ID in this city, and it's interesting. And this may be what's leading to the confusion, right? Is that almost every city that has a municipal ID is, guess what? A sanctuary city. Go figure. And in almost every case, immigration status does not matter. Cities like Chicago, New York, Oakland, Los Angeles, Austin, Baltimore, Detroit, Milwaukee, Newark, San Francisco. I know that's on your top 10 list of cities to emulate, right? That's where we want to be. The common theme through all of these cities is most of them are broke. Most of them are a social mess, and most of them have more problems than they know what to deal with, and they've been wishy-washy on social services for the illegal population. And if you don't rise to the level of what they think is dignity and what they think is respect, you are a bad person. Why would we want to emulate these cities? Why would we not want to walk to the beat of our own drum? The other thing they all have in common is they're Democrat-led. No big surprise there either, right? So here we are with our ID, and there's about 21 different ways to prove who you are to get this ID. It can be like any organization or association that, you know, would have a picture, your name, and your date of birth, your age, right? So is it hard for anyone out there to imagine that we're going to have some NGO, nonprofit organization that's going to be out there that all of a sudden they're going to be starting to issue library cards and things of that nature and some form of an ID to be able to support getting a municipal ID without ever providing a birth certificate, a driver's license, or a passport? Right? Why? Because this is set up intentionally to confuse people and circumvent the laws of the state of Louisiana in this country. I mean, call it for what it is. I mean, the other thing that's very interesting about all of this as well is that in the description of every single one of these cities, one of the driving forces is inclusion. Right? And in fact, in this city, Natalie Rupp, the executive director of the Trans Income Project, said the IDs are a win for the LGBTQ plus people, as cardholders will have the option of including a self-designating gender marker that is not dependent on the gender marked on their birth certificate. So we know we're actually not going to do that. In fact, we are going to ignore, even if they provided the birth certificate, as it relates to gender. So RUP's organization worked with the city to establish three gender markers. They include M for males, F for females, and X for anyone who does not identify as a male or female. So they can make up something that they identify as. That could be if you're non-binary, gender non-conforming, gender fluid, gender expansive, in any way, she says. So this allows people to more accurately reflect themselves on their ID. So what is the purpose? Is this just a feel-good measure that all of these cities are actually engaging in to promote this inclusivity that they're talking about, to be able to have a government authentic recognition of who you want people to believe that you are, even if you're not that? And this becomes a priority for city government, who has exhibited failure after failure after failure after failure, and at the very least has proven that you can't walk and chew gum at the same time. And this becomes a priority. This becomes the priority to circumvent that there are two genders. We no longer follow the science, right? We only follow the science when the science embraces our ideology. Any other time, no sense in following the science. It's not of any value. It's not of any worth. Well, I would tell you, I don't see where this ID is of any value or of any worth at all, period. All this is an overt way of saying we are going to circumvent state law. We are going to circumvent what the majority of the population believes, because our ideology is our ideology, and we will go to whatever extent, we will waste whatever tax dollars to promote this ideology. Plain and simple. So, where will this be? One of the things they said here, and you should consider this and ask questions of these sheriff's candidates, that they will be allowed to use these IDs for law enforcement purposes. I certainly hope that when they go to, like, AFIS, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, or whatever they're calling it now, and you have no prints on record, that they're not entering information off of this ID. Because if they do, they will completely bastardize the criminal histories database across this country in a very short period of time. Really short period of time. And there are many of us that believe that is not by accident. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Mark Earhart, Executive Director of Grow Louisiana Coalition. He recently wrote an opinion piece about choose trial lawyers or Trump's energy agenda. Officials have been singing the praises of these alleged tort reform, he says, that did not address the lawsuits that threaten the coastal jobs as well as investment of the energy sector. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, Newell, it's good to be with you again.
So, Mark, explain to us the mission and vision of Grow Louisiana Coalition and what brought you to this the authoring this opinion piece.
So the Grow Louisiana Coalition has been around since 2013, and we represent more than 100,000 people in Louisiana who either work in or alongside the state's energy industry every day. And we talk about three primary things as we go around the state meeting with people. The first is the economic importance of the oil and gas business to Louisiana and how it's more important today than really it's ever been because of how because of the opportunities that are available if Louisiana decides to take them. The second area is talking about how the state's energy industry is the number one private investor in Louisiana's coast. And the third area is talking around the state's legal climate and our current situation when it comes to trying to have it both ways, where we are trying to say verbally with our mouths, hey, we want energy investment in Louisiana. We are the best at energy development and oil and gas development in Louisiana. But then through our actions, we're trying to sue the industry out of existence. Because in particular, because of a series of trial lawyer-led lawsuits in a handful of coastal parishes saying that the oil and gas business needs to pay huge, huge amounts of money for work they did that was permitted by the state of Louisiana and allowed by the federal government. And this came to a head in April when Plaquemines Parish a jury in Plaquemines Parish decided to award the state and plaintiffs and trial lawyers about $745 million for work that was permitted and done starting during World War II for decades. And what we found out at that time is, number one, that verdict was really short-sighted and just was mind-blowing. And what's even worse, which speaks to our trial lawyer economy problems, is before the trial lawyers even got out of the courthouse, one trial lawyer said to somebody in the courthouse, well, it's not $745 million. We're going for $1 billion. If we have $400 million more we're going to go for to try and get our legal fees and things like that. And we're faced with a choice, and we're being told by the governor – and the Attorney General of Louisiana, oh, we are a pro-energy state. But they are trying to have it both ways. We are either at the altar of the trial lawyer economy, or we're for growing responsibly Louisiana's oil and gas business and the energy economy. We can't have it both ways.
So you don't believe that both can be true, but let me ask this question about the Plaquemines judgment. I thought there was evidence of activities that were performed by Chevron outside of what would have been legally allowed relative to intentional dumping of certain chemicals and other issues like that in the wetlands at that point in time and for many years. Is that not true?
No, well, the specifics, I'm not a scientist in that type of way and can't speak to those types of specifics.
But let's just assume for a moment, you know, to do away with all of this, what if there is evidence that they were properly permitted, it was a properly conducted activity, but there were activities that they engaged in that would not have been allowed under the existing laws at that time? Should they be immune from lawsuit?
Well, I think if you are issued a permit by the state of Louisiana, you have to operate by those permits. And I think that's where I disagree with what you said, is where you said under the laws at the time. What has been repeatedly shown and argued over and over again is that there was work done that was not only permitted at the time under the laws at the time, but that it was encouraged to be done. And that where these exorbitant lawsuits are coming in now, not only in Plaquemine, but in six other parishes, is trying to sue companies that have worked in Louisiana for decades under laws that didn't even exist when the work was done. My argument is, it's like me saying to you, Newell, in 1982, you filed your taxes a certain way and you did this, that, and the other thing. Well, I'm going to come back in 2025 under a law that was established in the year 2000, and I'm going to sue you for what you did in 1982 on your taxes. It just doesn't work, and we're allowing it in
Louisiana. You're not saying that. So my point is simply this. I mean, this total abolition of legacy lawsuits, I think, is a little bit of an overreach. And that's why I asked the question the way that I did, is that if they were properly permitted, you know, they were following most of the rules, but not all, and there was evidence that was brought forward by direct testimony or any other way that proved that they were dumping chemicals and other stuff into the wetlands, which was not an accepted practice at that point in time, should they be immune from lawsuit?
Under the laws of that time, is my opinion, as opposed to suing someone over laws that didn't even exist at the time, right? That's
right.
Really where, you know,
I get that. But, you know, a lot of people are in favor of this total abolition of legacy lawsuits. Is that y'all's position?
No, I think in Louisiana, where we've had a problem, there's a difference between the legacy lawsuits where you're dealing with individual landowners and oil and gas activity that took place on that land, and the coastal lawsuits, and which is around coastal permits and actual governments suing on behalf of landowners without the landowner's permission. With the legacy lawsuits with landowners and things, we have instances in Louisiana where you have individuals who are suing the same company three different times over the same issue. And that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem that has been tried to be solved over the last 20 years or so. And what I'm talking about is something, and I don't think, look, and you look at a place like Texas has a system in place that if you violate your permit, you have to do certain things. You are penalized, you have to remediate, you have to do all those things. And Texas does not have the legal problems anywhere close that Louisiana does. In Louisiana, we have a system that encourages people to sue one thing after another. And that's where we're at a disadvantage. But yeah, if you violated a permit, you need to rectify that.
Where does Grow Louisiana Coalition stand on this abandoned well problem that we've had for a long time? I mean, to me, it's a classic example of the industry not really fulfilling its obligation to the state, and we've set up a series of laws that grant these immunities out there or something along those lines, where we never can find out who actually owns the well, who's responsible for it. Allegedly, you can't transfer your liability, but it's done all the time, and nobody seems to be able to figure it out. And we have abandoned wells all over the place that have not been properly capped and not been properly remediated.
I think that there's a system in place now where we're as far along in doing the right things to get this problem fixed than we have been for a really long, long time. I think that there are funds that are now available to be able to go in and try to manage and handle the abandoned well problem, and I think those things are moving forward. I think from Grow, we don't get into the specifics in terms of how should this program work versus something else. I think from the people of the oil and gas business and the people who support the oil and gas business in the state, the people who are working in it, they want to do the right things. They want to be able to operate the industry, and they do it from a huge perspective. The people of the industry in Louisiana are working on behalf of Louisiana and working to do the right things. And
so,
where
so
we
you
are
say,
always,
let me, because I'm running out of time, Mark, but I want to get this point out. So you say that the tort reform that was conducted during this last legislative session, that the folks are being misled by that as it relates to what we're just talking about, legacy lawsuits. What would you change? What would the bill look like?
I think the point I'm making is we're talking about the reform that was done during the legislative session while missing, we're putting a Band-Aid on a cut where we're missing a gaping chest wound. And the gaping chest wound is the coastal lawsuits. And the governor and the attorney general of Louisiana have the ability to stop this. And every time they're put to the test of saying, why are we doing this? Where other states are advancing energy development and following what President Trump wants to do, why is Louisiana continuing to try and sue the largest companies on the face of the earth for the work that they were invited to do here? And that's what we're missing. And we keep getting excuses. The attorney general says, I'm for energy. Well, 16 states' attorney general signed a letter agreeing with President Trump on his energy agenda, Texas, Florida, Arkansas, Alabama. The one state that's missing is Louisiana. And even if you look beyond Plaquemines Parish into the other parishes, the attorney general and the governor have the ability to stop these things, and they aren't. They're hoping that people don't really pay attention. And the people who support oil and gas in the state need to pay attention, because the trial lawyers are winning out. And we're losing to the trial lawyer economy. That's where I'm at.
I would love to see what that looks like in verbiage, because it sounds like what we're promoting is an abolition of a certain type of lawsuit against actors, and that always, for me as a lawyer, is a very slippery slope when you have that, because there are all kinds of both direct and indirect actions that can be conducted by the tortfeasor, and it should be, and it has to be, a balance of interests, and it can't be one-sided.
I think you're exactly right. When we're talking about a balance of interest, I think that's exactly right. Except my point to that is the balance of interest is drastically in the favor of trial lawyers who are utilizing opportunities to make huge sums of money. And they are telling individual parishes, you're going to make a ton of money off of this. And in the meantime, they are sacrificing the biggest industry in the state, which is the energy industry, to get it.
Cutting and off your nose to spite your face. Fair enough. I got it.
Yes.
Mark Earhart, Executive Director, Grow Louisiana Coalition. Thank you so much for joining us today, and have a great week.
Thanks, Noel.
Thank you. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. WWL is your home for Saints football and your direct connection to Saints training camp this week in Los Angeles. Count on Saints legendary running back Deuce McAllister, Mike Haas, and Jeff Nowak to be your eyes and ears in Irvine. Tune in to Sports Talk every evening from 4 to 8 for the latest. Check in two or three times a day online for post-practice breakdowns, the latest Saints news, player and coach interviews, the daily notebook takeaways and observations, plus videos of practice highlights. You'll love black and gold football. Keep it locked on WWL for all the pro coverage. And also remember, you can stream all of these shows, all of our WWL Time Shifted podcasts, on the free Odyssey app, TuneIn, and the iHeartRadio app. Listen to the shows you love and the local content you crave when you want, how you want, on Odyssey, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn apps. And just as a reminder, this Sunday, 3:05 p.m., turn that radio on, WWL, Saints versus the Chargers, the first preseason game of this season. So looking forward to it as well. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Congratulations to Victor Whitaker of Mandeville. Victor won the Generac GP6500 portable generator valued at almost $1,000. You could win a portable generator, too, starting next week from Craig's Electrical and Generator Service and WWL, the Louisiana official emergency management station. When we come back after the top of the hour news break, we will be visiting with Kai Werder as part of our NOLA Coalition segment. Deputy Director of the Center for Restorative Approaches will talk about their violence interruption program and the impact they've had in schools. We'll also visit with Kelly Schultz, Senior VP Communications and PR for New Orleans & Company, Summer in the City, the culinary restaurant deals, and other August happenings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Newell on WWL.